Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 95 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 1042. All right, so as I said at the end of last session, we're ready to dip our toes in a little bit different waters. We went through the Melchizedek teachings in the Orient. I remember finishing up with their final flurry about Buddhism. Now they want to reset and go back to the beginning days, in the wake. Even you'll see even slightly reminding you immediately prior to Machaventa arriving, but mostly immediately in the wake of Machaventa leaving and the missionaries getting going. And obviously we're going back to home base here, and going to consider things from there again. I think I'll leave it at that. Let's read the opening little preface paragraph, and I'll make a few more comments here.
Paper 95, the Melchizedek teachings in the Levant. As India gave rise to many of the religions and philosophies of Eastern Asia, so the Levant was the homeland of the faiths of the Occidental world. The Salem missionaries spread out all over southwestern Asia through Palestine, Mesopotamia, Egypt, Iran, and Arabia, everywhere proclaiming the good news of the gospel of Machaventa Melchizedek. In some of these lands, their teachings bore fruit, in others they met with varying success. Sometimes their failures were due to lack of wisdom, sometimes to circumstances beyond their control.
Okay, it's kind of interesting that they remind us of the vicissitudes of this process also in the beginning. So one can be expectant of, like, well, I wonder, who's going to fall into which category here as we go forward. But the main thing in the first half of that paragraph, they're basically dividing the stories, you can see there, into what fed into the Orient, we've already gone through that, and then what feeds into the Occident. Before they address, literally getting more into the immediacies of Western civilization with Greece and et cetera, sort of the Occident proper, they want to address things closer to home, closer to Salem. Now, technically, the Levant, if you're not familiar, is the whole area surrounding the eastern half of the Mediterranean, basically. From Greece all the way around through Palestine and down through Egypt, heading over to Tunisia. That's technically the Levant, that immediate area around the Mediterranean Sea, the eastern end of the eastern half of the Mediterranean Sea. We're not just going to be talking about that when they say the teachings in the Levant, as you can kind of tell from the way they're talking about sort of homeland sources, like the way India was really the point from which things spread out in the Far East. By the teachings in the Levant here, they mean we're not going to stray too far from the literalness of the Levant, especially Salem. Obviously, we'll just go to the Near East, and we'll We'll touch upon Mesopotamia. We'll definitely go to Egypt, which is, you know, literally part of the Levant. But we're not going to go all the way around to Greece yet, because that's really setting the stage for, you know, going to Rome and into Western civilization. So that's the point of what we're immediately going to be looking at here. And as I said, you'll see here, as soon as we start reading the next paragraph, we're going to drop back and remind ourselves of what the state of affairs was immediately prior to Machaventa showing up in the Levant, and you know, how things were changing, you know, while he was there, and you know, and immediately subsequent to his time here. So let's see what they have to say here. You can see that they want to, you know, address the Mesopotamian situation first before they go to Egypt. Let's see what they've got here.
1. The Salem religion in Mesopotamia. By 2000 BC, the religions of Mesopotamia had just about lost the teachings of the Sethites and were largely under the influence of the primitive beliefs of two groups of invaders, the Bedouin Semites, who had filtered in from the western desert, and the barbarian horsemen who had come down from the north.
Okay, so, you know, go just 2000 BC, immediately prior. In other words, what they're saying right here is picking up where they left off when they were talking about the Andites in this area. So at 2000 BC, as they're saying there, you're at the waning tail of what you can call Sumerian culture, you know, post, but you know, stemming from Andite culture in Mesopotamia. And as there's, you know, pointing out, especially the barbarian horseman part there, the first inklings of the transition into Babylonian culture there in Mesopotamia. I mean, fundamentally, what changes it from Sumeria to Babylon, you know, or from Sumerian to Babylonian culture, are those barbarian horsemen. You know, so those, remember how you had Andites that get blended with other peoples in Central Asia? So they're an animated people, but there's a lot of blending with evolutionary stock. So they're not even really semi-civilized anymore. They're barbarian. But they're definitely of the horse riding mentality, stemming from the Andites. And so they come sweeping, you know, into Mesopotamia, you know, from the northeast out of Central Asia, and are the final step in, you know, and basically putting an end to Sumerian culture. You know, remember that as things go forward with Babylon, you still have a residual of that Sumerian phenomenon down in the farthest southern region of Mesopotamia. That's the Chaldeans. You know, those are the sort of the post-Sumerians, you know, even further diluted, you know, in terms of bringing that Andite culture down.
But peaceful, right?
Yeah, I mean, I remember, even all the way back to when the Nadites were, having their issues, right, with the Tower of Babel and all that, those Nadites that were in southern Mesopotamia always wanted to, it's like, okay, you guys just do whatever you want to do. If you want to kill each other, whatever, we'll just stay down here out of your way. And, you know, so they were always the more Pacific, you know, bent peoples. But, okay, that's a relative term. I mean, they were constantly, you know, battling because it was city states and, you know, and my God is better than your God, you know, between the city states. Remember, there's all of that. And then, as they're pointing out, you know, it's not just in the immediate past here, but for quite a long time, you have the, you know, what eventually becomes the Arabs, right, to the west, constantly, you know, coming in and wanting to take over the fruits of civilization there in Mesopotamia. So it's, you know, it's a long, complicated history of back and forthing. But it's you know, it's now in its waning times. By the time you get to 1800 BC, right, you know, we're talking about Babylon then, really, and not Samaria. All right. So that's the, you know, that's the context. You know, that, remember, that didn't really come forward when they were talking about Abraham's family and whatnot, you know, coming from Samaria and going over to Palestine. Those were times where, you know, maybe it was time to get out of Dodge. See, you know, let's head north and around the Fertile Crescent, and so things are getting, you know, looking kind of ominous. With all of these barbarians and whatnot. So now, so that things were shifting, and it's in that dynamic cultural shifting Reformation context that these Melchizedek missionaries are heading out into play. So, well, how does it go? Let's see here.
But the custom of the early Adamite peoples in honoring the seventh day of the week never completely disappeared in Mesopotamia. Only during the Melchizedek era, the seventh day was regarded as the worst of bad luck. It was taboo-ridden. It was unlawful to go on a journey, cook food, or make a fire on the evil seventh day. The Jews carried back to Palestine many of the Mesopotamian taboos, which they had found resting on the Babylonian observance of the seventh day, the Shabbatim.
Right, so interesting. So before we do anywhere, they do a little aside, reminding you right up front of you know, why it's important to step through some of the details in Mesopotamia here, because so much of what is eventually going to become Judaism, right, is absorbed out of their time in captivity in Babylon, right, in the 6th century B.C. Right? That was so you're setting the stage for what are going to be the some of the primary concepts and ritualistic approaches and whatnot in Mesopotamia that those exiled Jews are going to absorb and play off of, you know, as they really get the more tied to the future mode of Judaism going, right? Really get the Hebrew language as we know it today going, and all, you know, the more modern phenomenon comes out of the exile in Babylon there.
Yeah. How many times did Jesus have trouble with the Sabbath? What's coming after him?
Right. And so, notice, you know, that they even gave you the Latinized version of the Hebrew, you know, Shabbat, rather than the Latinized from the Greek that ends up being Sabbath. Okay, so, you know, they're just, yeah, you know, that just further, you know, trying to remind you of how, you know, the actual directness of Judaism before you have any sort of Greek modification of it and whatnot because of Alexander the Great and all that sort of stuff, right, is being laid down here. Yeah. Shabbat is being laid down more than Sabbath is being laid down, you could say, right? And see, and just, you know, pointing out that, you know, it's not just the Mosaic issues with diet and that sort of thing that feed into the Old Testament, that feed into the quote-unquote books of Moses. Some of that is being laid down long before, right? And it's not maybe not so much that when they go to Babylon they pick up that stuff and take it out with them when they're freed, but it was sourced long ago there in Mesopotamia and spread out, and was over there in Palestine and Egypt and whatnot, right? And that was the culture that they were maturing in, way, way, way long ago. They're reminding you, it's very important to appreciate how much of what becomes Judaism was acquired from others. Right? It's, you had the Bedouins that had their volcano god, in Sinai, but a lot of the culture, came from other places, because this is this most fertile place. We're talking about the Fertile Crescent, after all. This is, but culturally fertile, place for all the way back to the first epical revelation. Right? So there's a lot that's just there, coming down from 500,000 years ago, even. Okay, that they're accumulating modifying and being modified relative to others and whatnot, that eventually ends up being Judaism. Including some of the things that might be thought of as so original to them, like the Sabbath. It's like, no, that's not really Jewish, right? It's pre-Jewish. It's kind of fun to think about the restrictions on things, like cooking food and stuff, being not tied to the desire to be reverent about the sacred, but tied to the fear of the evil. to see it, as it was flipped around in the very ancient past. As we saw when we went through evolutionary religion, you get some notion, and the basic notion stays, it just gets re-rationalized over and over and over again, positive, negative, what have you. But the core little thread just keeps going. And then the other thing is just the technical thing. But the custom of the early Adamite peoples in honoring the seventh day, well, besides just the seventh day, the 7 days, remember that goes all the way back to, Dalmatia. And setting up a 7-day week, since it was really close to take it times four and getting a month, it was very handy. And you could play off the number 7 for completeness and all that sort of stuff. All the way up to Adam and Eve and all the way down from Adam and Eve, everyone has been going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I mean, no matter how much anything else has changed, what you call a year or a month or whatever, the week, we've been counting that without break for 500,000 years, keeping track of that sevenfold order. It's so sacred just in the fact of the week, let alone a particular day being sacred. And I mean, how many things do we hold that sacred that they're unbroken for 500,000 years? I mean, can you name anything else? See, it's a very, very deeply sacred concept to us, the week of 7 days.
I don't know. You can buy beer on Sunday now.
Yes.
We're slipping. Yes, individuals can lose track of which day of the week it is. But as a whole...
Yeah, the civilization, or whatever passes for civilization, has been keeping track very religiously. All right, so that's interesting. So we've got that little detail. What else do we have in Mesopotamia here?
Although the Salem teachers did much to refine and uplift the religions of Mesopotamia, they did not succeed in bringing the various peoples to the permanent recognition of one God. Such teaching gained the ascendancy for more than 150 years and then gradually gave way to the older belief in a multiplicity of deities.
Yeah, see, so in other words, by the time you sort of have Babylon kind of fully up and rolling, the Salem teachings in any direct way have diffused. Okay. So, you know, in any sort of really Babylon proper, you don't have the Melchizedek missionary sort of coming into it. They're coming in, you know, in this waning Sumerian, rising Babylonian time. You know, we'll see here as we read forward why it is that it didn't last for long. You remember in the first paragraph there, it said, due to lack of wisdom. What exactly, you know, was the wisdom blind spot here? You know, why was this so so short-lived in any sort of, unpolluted, undiluted way?
Yep. So, you know, when you read the Orange Book, you know, when I first started reading it as, you know, as a Christian upbringing, the whole concept of more than one God, you know, was difficult for me.
Uh-huh.
In other words, but you read the Orange Book, and, you know, when they use the word deity, I mean, in a way, there's a lot of gods.
Oh, yes.
Other gods. Now, they all have, you know, obviously, you specifically learn who they are, but still, this multiplicity of deities, does that have any truth in it? Or is it small d versus capital D?
Well, see, notice that they do the small d. So let's just pause and note that for a second again. Remember that the point of doing the lowercase d deity is to say that, okay, they basically have a lowercase g god, but if they don't just say lowercase g god, if they say lowercase d deity, they're reminding you that more than it being some sort of a person, really fundamentally it's a concept personified. Okay? You know, there's a certain concept, a certain mode of functioning, if you will, that they're focusing on. Now, and then that's personified as a lowercase g god. That's the point of not just saying God, but saying deity like this, you know, is to remind you of how, it's tied to some specific thing. And a lot of that, again, goes back to 500,000 years ago when you had the prince's staff divided in, you know, these were the ones about agriculture, you know, these were the ones about science, you know, et cetera. They had these concept categories. Right, and so that basic modality, continued on, eventually humans were making their gods based upon, say, the sphere of their society that was focused on agriculture, right, and there needed to be a god over that sphere.
So bringing the whole concept basically down to earth, or down to, mm-hmm. you know, a lower level, as opposed to, you know, my confusion is in reading the Orange Book, you know, there's a plethora of deity, so to speak, that's basically like God, but, you know, I mean, obviously different than the Father.
So right, so yeah, so now I'm going to answer the rest of your question there, yes. Yeah, so that's the bit with right here, but how does it work when you go to capital G God and capital D deity? When you're talking about capital D deity, don't think of a set of individualized concepts like these lowercase d deity concept things I was just talking about.
You mean like God of the Sevenfold or things like that?
Wait, I mean, yeah, just to start with just... You have deity, The fundamental quality of deity is unity, okay, not individuality. Okay, so you don't start with, well, there's this individual category like agriculture, and there's this individual category like fertility, and not like that. Start with unity, okay, and then think in a, it's a, there's a literal substance and a very, very transcendent of matter, mind, and spirit energy, that literalizes this very transcendent unity nature, capital D deity. And then you get into some detail. You go, well, but you can't just think of it monolithically in thinking about it as fundamental quality as unity. But you don't want to break it up into individuality. So how can we make it a little more complex without literally just breaking it up into many parts? The analogy I always use is, think about how, you have a crystal, like a quartz crystal, and it's one crystal, but it has many facets. So use that analogy, use the facet analogy, and think about deity as having facets. You're not breaking it into different globs, okay? All right. So you don't have one glob that's called the sevenfold and one glob that's called the Father and one glob that's called the Son or something like that. You just have deity, but it has facets. Okay, and one facet is the Son, one facet is the Father, one facet is the sevenfold, one facet's the Mother, etc. And then on top of that complexity, you say this very transcendent influence that we call personality can engage relative to one of those facets and personalize it, like the facet that's called the Son. You can personalize that as God the Son. Personalized deity. It's like, well, which facet of deity? The Son. God the Son. Okay? Or God the Father, God the Mother, God the Supreme, etc. See, when you're looking at it in this top-down mode where you have a capital G then for God, that personalized deity, and a capital D for the deity, you're starting in a unity mode, whereas the bottom-up, lowercase ones, is starting very individuated. It's starting very like us, right? Not only are we individual blobs of matter, but our mind, we have very material-based minds, and so our minds fundamentally start with breaking things up into separate concept blobs, right? And there's, okay, well, there's this concept, and then there's, there's an empty space, and then there's this concept. We think in individuated terms to start with, very naturally, and so we work bottom-up in that mode. Okay. All right. And so, see, that's the difference between their multiplicity, that polytheism of multiple lowercase g gods, compared to there's many capital G gods. But see, when you're looking at it in the top-down sense, there's just one deity, really, many facets. Mm-hmm. Okay. See, so there's this very, very transcendent truth to monotheism, in that you have this continuumness of deity, right, in the top-down sense. You don't literally just have one God, in sense. So you don't, instead of thinking of monotheism as being valid directly factually. Right? It is valid in truth, right? And then there's a single continuumness of deity, upon that continuumness of capital D deity, there are many capital G gods, Right. So it's
a capital F fast.
Right. Okay.
That was a good analogy.
But it's always surprised me going through this history that it's such a priority to get the monotheistic concept established with people.
Right.
They were just saying,
yep,
you know, 150 years or whatever they had. So, but it, so it's almost like you can't even get to a concept of the real God without having that that monotheistic concept to start. Like, you can't have the multiplicity concept to even access God.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and even to get to the fifth epical revelation, all that stuff I was just saying, that complicated stuff with capital D deity, I was just saying. I mean, if you don't start with a definitive, just simple factual notion in your head of monotheism, how can you expand upon that and get to the greater truth of things that I was just describing? You know, you can't, you know, it might appear, it's like, oh, it should be easy to go from polytheism, literally with lots of lowercase g gods, directly to the Urantia book with all its capital G gods. It's like, no. No, that's not any sort of a direct process at all. You know, I mean, you literally need to think about that. That process is down on the bottom of some sort of hourglass image, and you're going to reciprocate it. It's all going to collapse into a singular, monotheistic, simple, factual notion of a God, and then it's going to expand out as you go up, you know, and be made new into many capital G gods above. All right, so, yeah, did I lost track?
No, yeah.
Can't remember all the things you asked there, if I got to all the questions there. But but anyway, it's, you know, it takes a lot of reflection, as you're saying, John, to work through that, you know, and figure out how you go from where you start to where the Urantia book would like to take you. You know, it's not at all straightforward. You know, and you know, many people who earnestly enjoy the Urantia book, you know, honestly, are not going to be able to work their way through that whole process.
No,
you know, in this life, it's just it's too much to work through and redo. You know,
they'll get it in, you know, in another life.
Right, and you'll keep going, but.
But you're right. I mean, it's an interesting concept. It's fairly new, and it's hard really to wrap your hands around it. I like the analogy of the crystal. It helped me be able to see the difference, you know, of the facets of deity being all part one, but as facets of deity. At the same time, you know, it's hard for me not just to worship a heavenly Father.
Right.
You know,
yeah. See, and I mean, yeah. And see,
period.
That approach that I was talking about, I mean, that is so not what you do immediately. The revelatory mandate for the fifth epical revelation told the revelators, in general, you're not allowed to talk to them directly in that mode. You know, basically, they were told that you need to work through the topics that you're going to work through, mostly in a mode that's the reality perspective, that has no deity at all in it, no capital deity at all in it. It just has reality. It has the seven absolutes of infinity. See, when you're talking about the seven absolutes of infinity with the universal phenomenon, you're not talking about deity at all. You're talking about individualities in the reality perspective. You know, but various places in the book, they suggest the rest of the picture, right? That there's deity and reality. Right? There's not just reality. And you can set aside all of reality, all seven absolutes of infinity, completely take them off the board, and start totally fresh and considering just deity. And unpack that whole picture. And so then you end up, you have two pictures. You have a fully unpacked reality picture and a fully unpacked deity picture. And then you need to work on understanding how the two are related to each other. You know, how in various ways it's sort of like, well, if you look at it from this side, it's reality. And you turn it around to this side and it's deity. Okay? See, so it's very complicated, right? For a beginning student to try to wrap their mind around all that complexity. And it also is, it can be not at all obvious. You know, you're reading and it's like, what's all this deity stuff Chris is always talking about? It looks to me like all you need is the seven absolutes infinity. And, you know, it's like, yeah, but then notice when they tell you, well, we've been told to kind of write it that way. But, you know, remember they tell you right up in the first paragraphs of the foreword that there's not just reality, but there's also deity. you don't have to get to paper 105 until they mention that, right? I mean, it's there lurking behind the scenes, waiting for you to feel solid enough about reality, which is a direct expansion of the monotheism into what seems like this weird new polytheism with the eternal son and the conjoint actor and the supreme being and whatnot. See, in the reality perspective alone, it really starts to kind of be disturbing as being, isn't this just going backwards into polytheism? See, to see that it really isn't, pardon the pun, it just appears that way because you're only considering reality. If you set that aside and get deity, like I was saying, you can rediscover the truth of monotheism in the deity perspective and then see how, despite all appearances, it isn't really polytheism in that reality perspective with all those different quote-unquote gods. I mean, 700,000 creator sons and, you know, all of whom are God. And I mean, et cetera. You know, it's not as retrogressive as it appears. Yeah. I mean, think about how fascinating it is to, you know, you're sailing over the Pacific Ocean and you see a whole bunch of islands. And you go, well, there's that island, and then there's just water, and then there's that island, and then there's just water, and then there's that island, and you know, and then one day you discover, yeah, but if you follow those blobs of land down beneath the surface, go all the way down the seamount sides, down to the ocean floor, it's all one ocean floor. The islands weren't really as separate and polytheistic as you thought. Right? You went down to the core and it was all one deity at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Okay. That's a simple analogy where you can think about, you know, if you look at it from underneath, there's just one ocean floor. You look at it from the top, there's many islands. It's like, well, how can you put those two together? You know, the mystery of how they come together is, you know, hidden in the water.
This is the point where you discover real work. It's like, okay, you've come through the sevenfold, and you thought you did some work. And you thought, okay, I'm feeling like I got this. No, forget that. Now we're gonna start doing some real work.
Yeah, I mean,
Grocking did.
You know, and you know, obviously, you know, even if you spend many tens of hours getting the beginnings of some of this, you know, that's just what little small minds like ours can get down here. Imagine how you'll be taught about this stuff throughout your whole ascension career and beyond, you know, when you can really handle complicated things. You know, you think my total deity seminar is complicated, you know, wait till you get the classes on high.
But see, this construct is priming you.
But you got a better mind,
though. Yes, right.
Otherwise, you wouldn't get it with this mind.
Right. Right. But just because you have a better mind doesn't mean that it isn't fundamentally a lot more complicated what you're having to learn, right?
Yeah. The things you're going to confront are
It's like, you remember, you know, you think music down here is complicated. Then they tell you about, you know, try to tell you about the celestial artisans. Mm-hmm. It's like, wait till it's really complicated. Then music will be complicated. Okay.
Glorious.
Yeah, it'll be glorious, too. All right. Meanwhile, back to Salem and the teachers. What do we have here next?
The Salem teachers greatly reduced the number of gods of Mesopotamia, at one time bringing the chief deities down to 7. Bel, Shamash, Nabu, Anu, Ea, Marduk, and Sin. At the height of the new teaching, they exalted 3 of these gods to supremacy over all the others, the Babylonian triad, Bel, Ea, and Anu, the gods of earth, sea, and sky. Still other triads grew up in different localities, all reminiscent of the Trinity teachings of the Andites and the Sumerians, and based on the belief of the Salemites and Melchizedek's insignia of the 3 circles.
Okay, so not unlike, remember, you know, when the Melchizedek missionaries got to India, you had a similar situation. You had lots of different gods. And some of those gods' concepts were coming down from Andite, you know, conceptions and traditions, you know, from way, way, way back. So you got you have a similar thing here. And so these Melchizedek missionaries are saying, well, okay, how can we help them to begin to change this picture from just a whole bunch of gods, all kind of basically equal, all in the plane? You know, we need to try to somehow simplify this and kind of get them to stack it up a little bit if it were we were. Because remember, they're trying to get them to lift their attention up out of the plane, like we talked about before, and get an uplifted God concept that can eventually simplify into a monotheism. You lift it up out of the plane. And so just like in India, we see a very similar thing here. We've got a sky father, Anu. Right? You know, wherever you go, where there are Andites, there's going to be a sky father in there somewhere. Whether it's Zeus or whomever, right? There's going to be a sky father. And so you have this, you have that here. And so if you're immediately thinking, oh, okay, maybe even more than in India, maybe that's what they're going to do here. Maybe they're going to kind of boil it down, you know, to 7, and then they're going to boil it down to 3, and then they're going to take the 1 that's the sky father and, you know, really say that's the most high. Maybe that's what they can do here. You know, remember we saw it, didn't kind of work that way in India because with all of the machinations with the Brahmin priesthood, it kind of all unraveled, you know, and then ended up getting all totally fuzzed out into, you know, that diffuse concept of the Brahmin, and we didn't have any individuality left, right? But you're thinking, well, maybe it's going to be different here. Maybe, you know, cause maybe they won't get that fuzzed out stuff like those Eastern people were, you know, so tended to do. Maybe they'll stay individuated and they can work with this. Let's see. Anything else I should say there? You know, I won't go into details, but you know, it's just like always, you know, you're obviously coming out of that evolutionary religion where you know one of these is probably tied to the sun and one's probably tied to the moon, and right, and then some are going to, like they're pointing out, it might be kind of general like earth, sea, and sky, or it might be a little bit more specific with fertility or what have you, or wisdom, or yeah. You know, they're in that sort of mode, just as you might expect. Anything else there? Oh, just notice again, it's chief lowercase d deities. You see they're reminding you again that you basically have these personified concepts, you know, that you're dealing with. All right?
Never did the Salem teachers fully overcome the popularity of Ishtar, the mother of gods, and the spirit of sex fertility. They did much to refine the worship of this goddess, but the Babylonians and their neighbors had never completely outgrown their disguised forms of sex worship. It had become a universal practice throughout Mesopotamia for all women to submit at least once in early life to the embrace of strangers. This was thought to be a devotion required by Ishtar, and it was believed that fertility was largely dependent on this sex sacrifice.
Okay, so not only very, very strong sacrifice concepts, like we saw when we were going through evolutionary religion, but the biggie, sex. That very powerful energy that, like we read back there, in going through evolutionary religion, that so often very, very abstracted and reverenced, right? And developed into all sorts of complex schemes that people fixated on. And and remember how they mentioned it was often a delightful construct when they would come up with these elaborate schemes surrounding sex, because it was a way that you could rationalize, having sex outside of marriage. And all of its constraints. And so both men and women, remember, they said, delighted in these clever species of self-deception that humans come up with. So at least one of the issues, you can tell, that's going to end up blowing up their whole enterprise here is the sex goddess. Energy is just too powerful to tame, as it were, culturally, right? But then you go, well, wait a minute. I mean, maybe that's part of their problem. I mean, you can already see it. It sounds like they're really getting into the weeds with the moray system, right? Is that what they're supposed to do? Right? Did Malcaventus say, now I want you to go out and I want you to get into the weeds of everyone's moray system and try to change all their mores? No, he didn't send them out to do that. Right? Now, it's the case, remember we talked about that to move an evolutionary religion forward, you have to, get sort of a new spirit, as it were, in the moray system, and then they distill a new cult out of that, an improved evolutionary religion. Yes, okay, but it's one thing to be approaching them in a way where they can assimilate what you're offering into the moray system. It's another to go right at their moray system and say, approach them in an anti mode, right? We're here to say that moray is bad, that moray is evil, that taboo is wicked, or whatever. That it's obvious that that's a problem, and you'll see as we read forward, it definitely is. But in terms of just specifically, it was very difficult for them to, to get people to set aside this whole goddess of fertility concept. It was so popular. Various forms of the mother cult, were very popular because of Eve, remember, going all the way back to Eve, and because Cain, and Cain was only tied to Eve and not Adam. So that energy's in play. That continues to be a problem. That continued to be a problem for Christianity to try to deal with the mother cult. Now, lest anyone misunderstand, I'm not saying that there isn't God the Mother. Okay, but it's to get to the genuine God the Mother, you have to go to the deity perspective that we were talking about. You really can't understand what God the Mother is in the reality perspective. And thinking that you know what God the Mother is just because there's a Creator Son and a Creative Mother Spirit, it's like, no, no, no. That's going to make you think Adam and Eve, you're one step away from Osiris and Isis, right? You know, Ishtar, okay? That's not the nature of God the Mother. You can't really start with that individuality viewpoint from the bottom up and understand really what the Revelators mean by God the Mother. You can begin to get an idea of what they mean by God the Father. But no one is, you know, the four epical revelations before didn't approach the subject of God the Mother, because, you know, there's no way they could approach, let's set aside reality and consider deity. Okay? I mean, you're talking to people that, you know, barely have a hold of reality, right? You know, let alone such a firm hold that they can, you know, kind of, as a thought experiment, set it aside and consider something else. To get to the genuine God the Mother, you know, you have to let go of this anthropomorphic sort of notion, and you certainly need to let go of your fixation on sex, right? And looking for God the Mother to satisfy that desire to have something in your religion that fixates on sex. Right, like we're seeing there, you know, people in Mesopotamia were doing. There's a place for understanding where the duality of sex comes from. Okay, but that's another story.
How did this pollute the Mithraism? They get twisted on the mother concept.
Well, again, you remember, you know, you have Mithraism and you have the Great Mother, God the Mother cult. And the two of them come together into Catholicism. And it's, you know, you had separate worshiping, you know, side by side of the two, and then you just, you know, built a big roof over both of them, melted them together, right? And the fact that it had a heterogeneous origin like that, you know, that tension in the Catholic Church survives to today. You know, people in Catholicism that really focus on the mother cult side of things, you know, that's been reworked in with Mary, right? You know, and then those who don't, the tension is there, and just because it's such a, accreted evolutionary product, where you just separate balls together into one, you know, oblong ball.
But the headwater from Mithraism was...
Mithraism, you know, doesn't, you know, go back to the mother cult. I mean, again, it's you know, there's two separate headwaters there. I mean, you know, Mithraism is just... we shouldn't maybe go off on this tangent too far, because that's coming up later on when we get into further papers. I mean, but that's, you know, let me just stop there. Yeah, rather than going on and on about it. It has a different story, and we'll get to that story eventually here. You know, you tee me up, and I want to just start going on and on. We'll never get to the subject there.
Because you want to cease to resist.
Okay. But anyway. So, you know, this very anthropomorphic mother god, you know, issue is, you know, remember, we're not just reading history here. We're trying to remember what issues are still in play right now in you, right? What tendencies you have, right? As you read this book, you're going to have a tendency to, you know, Isisize or Ishtarize or however you want to say it. The very, you know, like the Creative Mother Spirit. You know, I'm telling you, don't do that. It's like, well, why not? It's like, well, eventually you'll understand if it isn't obvious to you already. Don't go that path. There's glory in God the Mother. And, you know, the only way that you can really understand the glory of God the Mother is to not just make God the Father a woman. Don't do that. Okay, that's not how you get to God the Mother. Okay?
What? They're not trannies, right?
Okay. Like I said, I mean, it's just, you know, you have this God notion, and it's kind of, a lowercase d deity. It's like, well, there's the concept of female, and there's the concept of male, and so you end up with a personification of the concept of male and a personification of the concept of female, right, as a male and female god, like Osiris and Isis, you know, okay. No, you got to stop doing that, right? That's a lowercase d deity. God the Mother, right? The G is capitalized and the M is capitalized. They're not talking about that sort of stuff anymore. You know, just the concept of femaleness or something. You know, or even lowercase m motherness necessarily, right? All right. What else do we have there? We've read about all these schemes that they dreamt up with evolutionary religion about sex before, and largely dependent on this sex sacrifice, you know, and I'm sure they had endless rationalizations. If someone still managed to get pregnant, even though they didn't do this little sacrifice, you know, there would have been rationalizations for that. It's like, you know, maybe it's as simple as, well, yeah, but she's not as fertile as the one who did, right? There's fertility, and then there's fecundity. Maybe she bathed, you know, in a pool she shouldn't have been bathing in. Remember how we talked about that. They had all sorts of schemes about this. Right? And when you're that focused on material issues, right, like sex, how are you going to get to spirit? You know, how can you even get lifted up out of the plane, like I was saying, to get some sort of an uplifted thing that you're thinking of as the Most High? Right? Sex is really down in the plane. Right? That's the level of the flesh. So it's that's basically what they're saying. The popularity of Ishtar was a boat anchor on their evangelistic efforts. All right.
The early progress of the Melchizedek teaching was highly gratifying until Nabadad, the leader of the school at Kish, decided to make a concerted attack upon the prevalent practices of temple harlotry. But the Salem missionaries failed in their effort to bring about this social reform. And in the wreck of this failure, all their more important spiritual and philosophic teachings went down in defeat.
Yep, there it is. Continue to point out, but see, this is what really blew it up. As much as I just said that it was a boat anchor, but the primary problem is not how difficult it was to uplift these people because of all the vicissitudes of their notions. They were just focused too much on what they thought was morality, right, instead of on religion. Right? Now, Machaventa didn't say you only find favor with God if you outlaw temple harlotry. Right? He said, no, faith alone. Doesn't matter if you have temple harlotry. Right? Faith alone gives you favor. You know, and to this very day, it's almost impossible for any religionist to follow the simple message that Machaventa and then doubled down by Jesus gave us. We always want to get all wrapped around the axle with various so-called moral issues. Okay? And it's not that we shouldn't consider such things, but it's separate from religion. When you do get to the so-called moral issues, then you've got another part of the book to consider relative to that. It's like, well, okay, First of all, we need to completely redefine the word moral for you. You know, so it doesn't, it isn't just a synonym for the taboos of your mores system. Okay? And it's top down. Your morality is your conformity with the cosmos. You know, it's not your conformity with, against the taboos of your mores system. It doesn't have anything to do with sex at all, for instance. Morality, genuine morality, cosmic morality, has zero to do with sex, taboos or mores or laws or whatever. That's all a separate issue. What a society needs for laws to regulate the sex propensity. Okay. It doesn't put you in or out of conformity with the cosmos. As long as we're focusing on that for a second, just remind yourself, if you go back to the end of paper 34, the normal urges of animal beings and the natural appetites and impulses of the physical nature are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, or unfortunately over-conscientious persons. More poetic way of saying what I was just saying. Okay. And that's an unfortunate internal boat anchor to put on your religious potential and development, as they're saying there. I mean, they said, accept. Yeah. See, you can use your will in an unfortunate way to mess up your approach to spirit by falsely exalting this material stuff into something that, as if the Universal Father cares about sex. He's a little bit above such considerations. Right? But not in the minds of all of us mistaught mortals. Right? We think that's all he thinks about, is whether or not you've dotted the correct I's on the whole sex scheme. It's very unfortunate.
There's probably not an anti-component in true morality, cosmic morality.
Yeah, obviously. Right. I mean, the taboos have to be diametrically removed from the fact of morality, right? It has to be purely positive, not one iota negative, right? It's not an anti-conformity with the cosmos when you're moral.
Right? That would set a lot of people free of the truth of that.
Yeah, right. But it's very, as we went through in the whole evolutionary religion, that is so difficult to free yourself from that natural instinct that we all have to think in debt terms, and in taboo terms. But to think in grace terms, in gift terms, in positive terms, in love terms instead of fear terms. Nothing natural about identifying with the God of love. Everything natural about fear-based notions. Animals have gods based on fear. Humans have gods based on love, to put it bluntly. All right. So they get all fixated on the temple harlotry stuff. Notice how apropos this is to Jesus, He dares to even talk to a harlot, and everyone is in a running around with their hair on fire. Like I said, we all know right to today it's still a problem. Okay, because they so focused on trying to change their mores system, their whole positive spiritual philosophic effort went down the drain, and the key thing there again, you know, that I bring up often, if you have some spiritual animation in your mind, if ideals burn within you, if you have a desire to see the world around you more like the ideals you envision, okay, we all need to learn that you can bring the truth of those ideas out into the world without having to rearrange the molecules, right? Change them so there aren't harlot molecules or whatever. Right? You don't have to rearrange the external world for it to have potential for you to bring truth in its midst, right? And what it takes to be able to do that is something called wisdom. Remember they said that? Lack of wisdom?
Yeah, but how's this different than cleansing the temple, so to speak?
Yeah, see, exactly. And the very fact that we think like this is why everyone has a false understanding of the cleansing of the temple thing. It's impossible to not think about that story inappropriately. No matter how many times you read it in the Urantia book, you don't really read it in the Urantia book. You read it in your mind in the New Testament, and you interpret it in the Old Testament way. Right? And you place upon Jesus the role of these unfortunate Melchizedek missionaries. It was the other people that were getting in that mode like these Melchizedek missionaries, not Jesus. Right? And it's very difficult for us. We actually want Jesus to be doing this mode. We're offended by temple harlotry, right? And someone ought to just, upend it and, say no, right? That's what I said. If you burn with ideals, sure, idealistically, women would be living more fulfilling, enriching cosmic lives than that. But you have to stay in the times you're in. We don't live in the age of light and life. Right? Like the Revelators point out, women are just now moving into a cultural setting where they can begin to try to figure out what they really are in and of themselves. Remember what I was saying? You can't get to God the Mother by just making God the Father a woman. Right? You can't get to a real woman by just making a man, quote-unquote, a woman, right? Women imitating men is not real women. Or women, even though we need to assist each other, even that isn't the fullness of a real woman, a woman assisting a man, any more than a man assisting a woman is a real man.
Let alone a woman.
Right? What are you really in and of yourself, right? For the first time in human history, women have this opportunity to begin to try to explore that domain. What exactly potentials are there? Remember, a normal world in the post-pastoral sun age cannot even be remotely imagined by any of us. It's so different than anything we can even imagine. So you got to ask yourself, where could some of that completely different, unimaginable stuff come from? There must be latent potentials in us, right, that we have yet to even get a glimpse of yet, that are manifesting, in full to make it so different I can't even imagine it right now. I'll bet you there's one of them. What a woman, right? More as a source of originality in and of herself. And remember the Revelators say, don't think this isn't a challenge for you because you have a maternal instinct. So the first instinct is not to find your originality in and of yourself, it's to be a mother. Okay? But that's not, you as a woman, that's you as a mother. Right? It's different. And the difference is unknown, really. Right? We live so short a life, for one thing. You barely have time to stop being a mother, and then we die. Right? Even when you're you've gone through menopause, you're still, your maternal instincts so strong, you're still really kind of in the mom mode, you know. I mean, you know, it'd be very different if you had a higher genetics and you were living to be 500. Okay? Just think about all the time you'd have to, and an ability to sort of find what's really in you.
Yeah. There's a lot more to the mother spirit than a womb.
Yeah.
A lot.
Right. Right. So, you know, that's one of the exciting vistas of exploration for, you know, that mankind, humankind, you know, has to look forward to. Okay, meanwhile, back to the story. So all of this issue with the Moray system is how they really got themselves wrapped around the axle and you know, made it so that not much in a direct way is going to be enduring in Mesopotamia for the Melchizedek missionaries. Okay.
This defeat of the Salem gospel was immediately followed by a great increase in the cult of Ishtar, a ritual which had already invaded Palestine as Ashtoreth, Egypt as Isis, Greece as Aphrodite, and the northern tribes as Astarte. And it was in connection with this revival of the worship of Ishtar that the Babylonian priests turned anew to stargazing. Astrology experienced its last great Mesopotamian revival. Fortune-telling became the vogue, and for centuries, the priesthood increasingly deteriorated.
Okay, so two interesting things. I mean, look at the reactionary thing. I mean, not only did their efforts basically fall flat as Melchizedek missionaries, but a reactionary phenomenon, it made the whole Ishtar fixation worse. It's like, oh yeah, you want us to get rid of Ishtar? Well, we're going to double down and be even more devoted. Right? We're going to make, you know, 98% of our lives orbit about that instead of 80%. Right, so it made that, and like you're pointing out, it's spread everywhere. I mean, it's all the same, you know, whether you're talking about, like I said, Isis or Aphrodite or whoever you're talking about, it's all the same Eve-based, you know, goddess notion, fixated on fertility. And then in addition to that, it spun up a very, you know, the final sort of finishing touches of complexity on astrology, you know, that carries forward to today. You know, you have minds there in Mesopotamia that are with some Andite uplifting. So you have some minds that can get really sophisticated in this scheme. Right, it's not simplistic, and so that you know, and of course the positive side of that is, it's the beginnings of astronomy, right? In that sophistication, but you know, all of the superstitions and whatnot and acausal theories, you know, still haunt us today. Okay, so it's like, good job, Melchizedek missionaries. you made the sex fixation even worse, and you spun up the whole fortune telling and whatnot sort of stuff, you know, even more. So this is not looking too positive. What else do they tell us here?
Melchizedek had warned his followers to teach about the one God, the Father and Maker of all, and to preach only the gospel of divine favor through faith alone. But it has often been the error of the teachers of new truth to attempt too much, to attempt to supplant slow evolution by sudden revolution. The Melchizedek missionaries in Mesopotamia raised a moral standard too high for the people. They attempted too much, and their noble cause went down in defeat. They had been commissioned to preach a definite gospel, to proclaim the truth of the reality of the universal Father, but they became entangled in the apparently worthy cause of reforming the mores, and thus was their great mission sidetracked and virtually lost in frustration and oblivion.
Yeah, and many a little group of idealists, even today, you know, suffer the same diffused, hopeless end.
Yeah, I remember we talked about Abner's missionaries were uncompromising.
Yeah.
Also, and that didn't work out. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Abner in particular. Yeah, I didn't know him. But
yeah. Yeah, and so... interesting. Yeah, obviously that paragraph, we've brought that up a million times in this group. Sudden revolution. What do you want? Fill in the blank. When do you want it now? Right? Right? It's that whole mentality. And notice what, the little suggestion they give you there between the lines. When it says... let's see, where was that? Towards the end there. But they became entangled in the apparently worthy cause. Right? But it wasn't really a worthy cause. Right? That wisdom, right, to know the difference. The mechanics of that is what we talk about all the time. You have an ideal, yes, the ideal is fine. But you need to translate that ideal into an idea that matches up with the here and the now, the facts on the ground, right? And is infinitely patient, right? So that it fits into an evolutionary process. You're not the evolutionary process. Evolutionary process just is. You're trying to strike step with it, trying to lubricate the process, but not define the process. Okay, all of that humility, Machiavelli, like they said, tried to get them. It's like, okay, just focus on this. You know, if you have to put blinders on so that you don't think of other things, do it. But the Melchizedek missionaries failed. Jesus' apostles and disciples failed in the exact same way, right? Because they all broadened and got it all entangled in the whole Mori system and everything.
Yeah. Take people into the temple before you start discourse.
Very appropriate when you're thinking in terms of Machiavelli and Melchizedek and Jesus of Nazareth. Melchizedek of Salem and Jesus of Nazareth, that that's a spiritual mission, and they failed because they didn't keep it tightly a spiritual mission. And then the flip side of that is the fifth epical revelation that we're reading right now, which is not a challenge to the mores of the world at large, but it is a systemic challenge to you internally to completely rework everything inside of you. Okay, if you do that, it's even more difficult for you to relate to the rest of the world, right? I mean, for Jesus to relate to the rest of the world, he can conform to all of their basic mores, so he's immediately relatable there. You know, he doesn't match up with this spiritual core message he's trying to add to that mix, right? And had great difficulty just in adding that one little drop to the picture. If you completely change everything inside of you, all your science, all your religion, all your history, all your everything. Now, how difficult is this to match up with the rest of the world? It's very difficult. In many ways, see, you've pulled yourself out and you're in a parallel stream. You're going to yearn for some more people to pull themselves out so there can be a community in that parallel stream and not just you. Right, because there's kind of just a different culture that has to play there. Right? I mean, if you go with the Urantia book definition of religion, right, that has just no matchup with religion in the main evolutionary stream. Their religion is completely outer life. Your genuine religion is purely inner life. Right, and it's just, you're a fish out of water now. So it's, you know, there's a lot of difficulties. You know, you can't just sit down and talk paleontology with some paleontologist because, you know, or can't talk geology with some geologist or astronomy with some astronomer or history with some historian or whatever. I mean, you just, you know, you understand everything completely from a different predicate than they do. Right? You have no common foundation, really, anymore, you know, to engage each other. Yep. There was a question over here somewhere? No? Okay.
Well, now, wouldn't you have some kind of a renewed adeptness at these issues?
Yeah.
I know that's got to be coming, so...
Right. Obviously, the more you mature, you know, the more you can kind of patiently wait and look for, oh, well, now they just gave me a little opportunity. You know, because, you know, they have an encirclement of the Holy Spirit. And if they just let themselves rest unwittingly on it for a second, instead of polluting it with their false, you know, their unfortunate willful notions, I mean, you can engage them there, right? We have that in common, right? That foundational encirclement in the Holy Spirit. But it's so difficult. Most of the time, people are overruling that. Yeah. You know, they haven't entered the kingdom of heaven anew as a little child, as Jesus said, right? They're not back to that common core we have that we can relate to each other based upon, right? I mean, you know, many smart people have rejected common sense even. You can't even talk on a common foundation of what's supposed to be common sense, right? They think common sense is no such thing. So it's like, okay, I can't even fall back on that, right? I mean, what do you appeal to, you know, in them? Right? If they reject, you know, basic fact and causality and, you know, where do you start?
Well, you got the weather, you got
the football. Right. You got, you know, how about them Broncos? You got, you know, you know, how about the Nationals, you know? I mean, what are you talking about? And if the Broncos are having a bad season, right, you can't even talk about that. I see them. Yeah.
Nuggets in the answer. Right. There's a few sports you can work. Somebody's got to be in
the game. Anyway, you get the point.
Yeah.
All right. You know, so just don't get lost in 4,000 years ago here, you know, in Mesopotamia, you know, as I'm trying to show you. I mean, all of this is immediate truths that you can see that are relevant to you today. All right.
In one generation, the Salem headquarters at Kish came to an end, and the propaganda of the belief in one God virtually ceased throughout Mesopotamia. But remnants of the Salem schools persisted. Small bands scattered here and there continued their belief in the one creator and fought against the idolatry and immorality of the Mesopotamian priests.
Okay, so there was little pockets, in that, as they'll point out. You know, this is kind of not unlike the sort of the essence, even though it's not the substance of the Sumerians anymore, the essence kind of being in the Chaldeans, and that's still providing this little bit of fertile imagination to the civilization. Okay, so there's these little pockets that linger on. They're still kind of stuck on idolatry and immorality and whatnot. Okay, but they're voices that you know, could still be picked up on someone who has ears to hear, right? But it's a pretty still, small voice, right, in the midst of a cacophony of Ishtar and sex and what have you, right?
What kind of schools, do you have a notion what kind of schools, or there's a building, or schooling,
or little... Oh, no, we don't, no, just think schools of thought, uh-huh. You know, little philosophic threads. Remember, you have things like, these sorts of threads coming down and kind of being what, makes cynicism a separate mm-hmm. mode, in contrast to stoicism or whatnot. In that sense, right? Yeah.
I just want to make a note of the word propaganda.
Yeah.
generally, when I think of propaganda, I think of it in a negative sense, where untruth or deception is the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Propaganda is really a neutral word, and it can be propaganda for a high truth.
Are you trying to propagate something or not?
Right.
Right.
But yep. I agree, so, but they know that our connotation is negative, it's just funny that they use that, and they've used it throughout the last few papers several times in this connection with...
Well, they also know that you don't have to have more distortion of meaning if you so choose, right? You could go to the dictionary and look up the word and notice... there's something in there besides some drippy negative notion. Not to mention, how these words have played in religious contexts and stuff, have connotations because of that as well. I mean, all those things, the relevers are wanting you to think about all those things and sort through, the fullness of what the word denotes and what it connotes. All right, let's see what else. So this little sailing headquarters in Kish didn't last long. Remember, another thing about that is all of those city-states like Kish and stuff, like we said, there's a waning of that and, that very distinct Sumerian city-state phenomenon, and you're moving towards the Babylonian empire sort of a thing more, right, as we go forward. I guess that's all there. Yep, keep going.
It was the Salem missionaries of the period following the rejection of their teaching who wrote many of the Old Testament Psalms, inscribing them on stone, where later-day Hebrew priests found them during the captivity and subsequently incorporated them among the collection of hymns ascribed to Jewish authorship. These beautiful psalms from Babylon were not written in the temples of Bel-Marduk. They were the work of the descendants of the earlier Salem missionaries, and they are a striking contrast to the magical conglomerations of the Babylonian priests. The Book of Job is a fairly good reflection of the teachings of the Salem school at Kish and throughout Mesopotamia.
Ah, right. See, so there's one of the ways that this had an impact. Those, like I said, what we think of as Judaism, is mostly the best of other things collected together, including those oldest things that are very much pre-Jewish, like Job, and some of the soaring Psalms. I think everyone who's familiar with this paper knows we'll get more along this line as we go forward about how the best of the wisdom and the insight in those oldest Old Testament texts are coming from, this combination of Machaventa's influence with the residual Andite quality of mind. Right? The two together produce some very solid founding understandings of, like the Proverbs and things. Okay. Read some more.
Much of the Mesopotamian religious culture found its way into Hebrew literature and liturgy by way of Egypt through the works of Amenemope and Akhenaten. The Egyptians remarkably preserved the teachings of social obligation derived from the earlier Andite Mesopotamians and so largely lost by the later Babylonians who occupied the Euphrates Valley.
Right, so there's just, you know, hinting at what's coming up between Amenemope and Akhenaten. You know, those are the primary conduits, for bringing in so much that, you know, we now think of as the kind of the jewels of the Old Testament. Let's see. And of course, they're hinting at where we're going next here with the Egyptians. They remarkably preserved the teachings of social obligation. And see, like I said, derived from the earlier Andite Mesopotamians, so you've got that quality of genetic, reflective potential there, along with what Machaventa, managed to get fed into the system a little bit. The more you have something that isn't semi-civilized and is made barbarian by those barbarian horsemen, like they're pointing out there at the end, lost by the later Babylonians who occupied the Euphrates Valley. As transcendent a civilization as you had in Babylon compared to something in Palestine, say, or something, it's a far cry from the kind of civilization that was there long ago when it was more Andite. Right, and we just don't even really appreciate anymore just how much was lost, and buried from ancient times there. When we find something, far and wide in the world outside of Mesopotamia, it's like, ooh, look at this megalithic stone stuff that's very ancient. This is really cool. Okay, I mean, it's nothing like what you would have had way back, the more definitive Andite, Adamic culture there. One can really wonder what might be there to find if you did dig deep in some of those areas. The problem is, of course, it's they're all in that same area and they kind of rework on top of themselves, and so a lot of it may not be there to be even dug up anymore, but nonetheless, one day the midwayers can tell us about what it was like way back in the day there. Okay, let's read some more here.
2. Early Egyptian religion. The original Melchizedek teachings really took their deepest root in Egypt, from where they subsequently spread to Europe. The evolutionary religion of the Nile Valley was periodically augmented by the arrival of superior strains of Nadite, Adamite, and later Andite peoples of the Euphrates Valley. From time to time, many of the Egyptian civil administrators were Sumerians. As India in these days harbored the highest mixture of the world races, so Egypt fostered the most thoroughly blended type of religious philosophy to be found on Urantia. And from the Nile Valley, it spread to many parts of the world. The Jews received much of their idea of the creation of the world from the Babylonians, but they derived the concept of divine providence from the Egyptians.
Like I said, so much of what came to be the fullness of Judaism was acquired from others who were bringing it forward from the more distant past. So you've got their idea of creation. That has a lot to do with what they picked up in Babylon. The first creation myth in Genesis. And then that whole bit of divine providence, right, going all the way down to today. And remember, other places in the book, when they try to challenge, they try to clarify this issue of providence. the revelators didn't feel that the word was so corrupted that they couldn't use it at all. You know, they actually use it, and they use it both in lowercase p and capital P senses. But the capital P providence that you have here is not that reformed capital P providence. In other parts of the Revelation, this is this concept, it goes forward. And, what's the basic problem that they're not stating directly there with those and, all the way to today notions of providence? It's the same problem as our notions of God, our notions of prayer, our notions of so many things, of religion in general. They're all thought of as material ministries or material techniques. Okay, they lay into, how foolish it is for us to have this material ministry notion that we call providence. But there is a genuine providence, right, nonetheless. But you need to liberate it of all the foolish material ministry notions that we've attached to it. And that's difficult because the animal in us doesn't care about spirit. It only cares about material ministry, right? It wants, if the animal in us is cold, it wants to be warm, right? If it's hot, it wants to be cool. If it's hungry, it wants to be fed, et cetera, right? And that's, what drives us in general, right? So we yearn for beneficent material ministry to be poured out upon all flesh, right? Jesus had the darndest time trying to find anyone who was interested in anything else, right? They all just wanted free food and free healthcare. There was only a handful of people that he could even remotely get to think about anything else. Right? So,
sound familiar?
Yes, it's still today. It's like, gee, where have I heard free food and free healthcare before?
It's true. I think of times in my life where I felt that was providential.
Yeah.
Now, it's directly tied to material happenings.
Yeah.
Of course. There must be a truth thread there. There must be some relationship to spirit that's associated with it. I just have never really figured
it out. I mean, providence is a cosmic ministry, and the cosmos is a triune system of matter, mind, and spirit. Right? The providence is in the wholeness of that triunity. It will occasionally manifest overtly in the material domains, but that's not because it's a directly material ministry, right? In the same way that a human might occasionally find themselves seeming to be benefiting from some sort of angelic intervention or something. Okay, what do they say about that? Well, it's not because some angel was all worried about your material issue and stepped in just for your sake. Right? There's something much bigger in play that doesn't have anything immediately to do with you at all, but coincidentally, in the grand scheme of things. Right, you benefited a little bit from what's going on in the bigger sense.
When men and God go into partnership,
okay,
great and good things will happen.
Yeah, and it's and again,
that's
not an
easy statement.
Like I said, this is not okay. I mean, you get a lot of blowback, right? Trying to propagandize that little gospel, right? Because we like to think that prayer is all about us, and angels are all about us. Why else would they be here except to, wait on me hand and foot. And again, it's remember the animal in you is fearful and indolent, right? And is yearning for that sort of material ministry. The human in you is courageous and independent, right? It doesn't pine for that stuff at all.
It's funny you should say that. Because as I get older, you know, I used to pray for, you know, help me solve this problem. Help me get out of the goop, blah, blah, blah. Now, I've gotten to the point where I say, okay, you gave me a mind. Let me try and figure out if I can get what to do with it.
I'm going to talk to you to remind myself that I have a mind.
As opposed to you do it for me.
Right.
Give me a creative idea.
Okay. So anyway, enough said about Just remember that's what it's that providence, that material ministry thing that the revelators lay into in other spots that they're referring to here.
It was political and moral rather than philosophic or religious tendencies that rendered Egypt more favorable to the Salem teaching than Mesopotamia. Each tribal leader in Egypt, after fighting his way to the throne, sought to perpetuate his dynasty by proclaiming his tribal god the original deity and creator of all other gods. In this way, the Egyptians gradually got used to the idea of a super god, a stepping stone to the later doctrine of a universal creator deity. The idea of monotheism wavered back and forth in Egypt for many centuries, the belief in one god always gaining ground but never quite dominating the evolving concepts of polytheism.
Okay, so notice how this is speaking again to this issue of, well, I can't do anything here. The environment's not appropriate. I need to have someone by fiat change the whole environment, you know, and then, boy, am I going to do great things. You need to think, in a more holistic fashion. The favorable elements in the environment are not what you immediately think they need to be. Right? Rather than philosophic or religious, it was political and moral. Right? That opened it up. And then they give you an example of the whole bit of, I just beat you in a war, so my God's better than your God. You're going, wow, that's not going to help them, this process. That, how much more foolish could you get? It's like, no. Step back, look at it anew. That's actually a really positive thing, right? The evolutionary process is working with that, right? I mean, before you can put one God above all other false gods, you have to have the notion of that something can be lifted up out of the plane at all. And you start with an arbitrary just... because I said so, it's greater, right? But at least you have the notion of lifting it up, right? It's a step forward. Yeah. Someone is thinking in with a vertical dimension. They aren't thinking purely horizontal in their scheme, right? It's all for self-aggrandizement, right? But, you have to have some false notion of exaltation before you can find true exaltation. There has to be exaltation.
There has to be some lording over
before you can finally find the Lord, right? Right, and capitalize it. Yes, exactly.
Virgins get sacrificed.
The idealism in you is not interested in that sort of stuff at all, right? You need to put a bridle on it, right? Pull back on the reins, right, as need be, right? It's like, no. Stop judging the book by its cover. Think more deeply about it, idealism within me, right? See the potentials that your impatient eyes don't see, right? Your immature spiritual consciousness is hopelessly impatient, remember. Unfortunately impatient. Right? It needs to be educated. You can't just run with it. All right.
Adam and Eve, case in point.
Yeah, yeah, right.
What do you want to think?
And lots of other cases, you know. Oh, this was a great idea for, you know, but wait, when did it blow up our whole culture? Well, not because it was a false ideal. It's just that you tried to apply it too directly and too soon. You lacked wisdom in your application, not, you know, insight. Your insight is fine. That's a valid ideal, but you lack complete wisdom in how to apply it. So you actually made things worse.
Which is tricky sometimes. Wisdom comes from experience. And,
yeah, right.
When you haven't experienced it, you know, it's like,
yep,
there is some trial and error.
Yes, there is. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So you have to be willing to goof up like that and acquire the wisdom through that tribulation. Again, it takes courage to achieve wisdom.
Doesn't mean don't do anything. You gotta act.
No, you gotta act, right? And you gotta be willing to fail and try again. You know, and you see how so many people today, it's like, oh no, we don't want to ever fail. We want to make sure that we only act when we know it's going to all go perfectly forever. Well, that's impossible, right? No, you have to have the courage to just try something, knowing there's going to be issues. You're going to work through those. But think about how demonized that approach is anymore. I mean, you know, the idealists just detest that. You know, I mean, you're just going to do that? I mean, you haven't even considered all the possible negative consequences. It's like, I don't know, you know, that's not the way you approach things. You look at it, okay, well, let's do this, you know, and then let's work from there, right?
Break a few eggs.
You can't get from the beginning to end in one step. You have to take little steps. Each step of the way has problems, and that, you know, you get more wisdom, and that just, you know, is a predicate for the next step. You walk in an evolutional way, not in some idealistic fiat way.
So yeah, I was just thinking in the comments you were saying. So mm-hmm. It just looks like it were really, if you give into sense pleasures, whether they be the free healthcare, free food, really anyways,
yeah.
We all have to pay for it. Or just giving into sex pleasures or thinking that it's not a big deal. It's just, I mean, it goes to war, and then we go to war, and then we're killing each other over the deity idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's just a stumbling block. I think that, you know, maybe looking from an immaculate eye down, it's a little bit, it's the arrogance of the Lord, right, in a certain aspect, not being God.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, zeal of any flavor for some idea, whether, no matter whether it comes from idealism or just animal hungers, right? I mean, you know, humans learned long ago. It's like, read Proverbs, for Pete's sake. You know, I mean, humans learned long ago, you know, what happens if you just go for it, you know, in any way, shape, or form. It always leads to misery and suffering, right, for you and everyone else. I mean, you know, and no matter how many times we think, oh, this time it's going to be different, and it isn't, we keep thinking this time it's going to be different, right? We just don't seem to learn that you just can't be unbridled in your passions. And it doesn't matter if they're animal passions, you know, or based upon, you know, some high ideal that you've recognized. You can't be unbridled in your passion about this. Because it just, you'll just cause nothing but endless calamity, you know, without that bridle. I'm sure we'll go around the circle many, many more times before it sinks in. All right, let's keep going here.
For ages, the Egyptian peoples had been given to the worship of nature gods. More particularly, did each of the 20 separate tribes have a special group god, one worshipping the bull, another the lion, a third the ram, and so on. Still earlier, they had been totem tribes, very much like the Amerinds.
All right, so you know, that's why you have all of that animal, you know, imagery in the gods there in Egypt. because they're, you know, they're really like the Amerinds with the totem sort of concept. Okay, you know, if that wasn't obvious to you, there it is, right? You know, hence all of the all those classic Egyptian god images that everyone knows about. All right, and you know, look at the complexity. Each of the 20 separate tribes. So not that big a region and really complicated. Okay. So it could use some focusing, right, and moving towards monotheism.
In time, the Egyptians observed that dead bodies placed in brickless graves were preserved, embalmed, by the action of the soda-impregnated sand, while those buried in the brick vaults decayed. These observations led to those experiments which resulted in the later practice of embalming the dead. The Egyptians believed that preservation of the body facilitated one's passage through the future life, that the individual might properly be identified in the distant future after the decay of the body. They placed a burial stone in the tomb along with the corpse, carving a likeness on the coffin. The making of these burial statues led to great improvement in Egyptian art.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, so what are we talking about here? Remember salvation. You always have the concept of salvation going on. Okay, and it's starting in a very literal way. We're trying to save, you know, preserve the material body. So that's the point of bringing this in. Just like when we were talking about, you know, salvation from suffering or whatever it is, any sort of a religious scheme, there's some sort of salvation concept that's evolving forward. Okay, so here we see some of the beginnings of their thoughts about salvation. You know, and it's just stumbling upon soda impregnated sand, right, for a natural mummification process. All right.
For centuries, the Egyptians placed their faith in tombs as the safeguard of the body and of consequent pleasurable survival after death. The later evolution of magical practices, while burdensome to life from the cradle to the grave, most effectually delivered them from the religion of the tombs. The priests would inscribe the coffins with charm texts, which were believed to be protection against a man's having his heart taken away from him in the netherworld. Presently, a diverse assortment of these magical texts was collected and preserved as the Book of the Dead. But in the Nile Valley, magical ritual early became involved with the realms of conscience and character to a degree not often attained by the rituals of those days. And subsequently, these ethical and moral ideals, rather than elaborate tombs, were depended upon for salvation.
Okay. You know, we've got the whole bit about, you know, the purity of the heart, you know, and whether you get a thumbs up or a thumbs down when you're assessed, you know, and all that issue. But again, notice, you know, we all know what a, you know, gobbledygook complication and how many negative side effects there are to bringing in all sorts of superstitious magical notions. But, right, it has its place in an evolutionary setting. Here they're pointing out, quite delightfully, it gets them away from such a literal, material thinking about salvation, okay, to getting to something that coincidentally brings in conscience and character. You know, talk about backing into things, right? Right. None of them are, you know, we really need to upgrade our thinking about salvation and have it include more about conscience and character. No, they're just completely backing into this. You know, and like they said, and subsequently, these ethical and moral ideals, rather than elaborate tombs, were dependent upon for salvation. So you're going from a religion of matter to a religion of mind, ooh, next step, if you can get there, is a religion of spirit. Okay. They're backing into a religion of spirit. That's what they're getting at. So, you know, see, so again, be humble in engaging the world. The evolutionary process does really cool things with the most unexpected predicates. Right? Don't look at the world as nothing but negative actualities, like I say all the time. It's just filled with positive potentialities. The things that you think could never go anywhere positive will go somewhere positive. Be more humble, right? Pour a cup of water on the hair that's on fire, because if all the things you think are wrong in the world, just chill out a little bit about it. It's okay, right? Things will go forward in very delightful, unexpected ways.
They grew that from texting.
Yes.
Maybe we can grow something out of it.
Charm texts. and pointing out to you, where did the Book of the Dead come from? You know, this is how the Book of the Dead came to be. All part of this process of them moving forward. And see, the very fact that such unexpected things are moving forward, it's like, ooh, this place is ripe. I mean, a little bit of assistance here, and this could move forward. And, you know, they set up, where was that, somewhere up front, about how, you know, we're getting the process going that can lead to, Western civilization here. You know, and with both its immediate civilizational and its religious understandings. All right, a little more here.
The superstition of these times are well illustrated by the general belief in the efficacy of spittle as a healing agent, an idea which had its origin in Egypt and spread therefrom to Arabia and Mesopotamia. In the legendary battle of Horus with Set, the young god lost his eye, but after Set was vanquished, this eye was restored by the wise god Thoth, who spat upon the wound and healed it.
And Jesus just worked with that, right? As we all know, right? And it all goes back to the eye of Horus, right? Yeah, all those stories where eyes get restored. Notice a lot of these are little vignettes reminding you of the general discussion we had about all this in the evolutionary religion papers. You can see how they're touching upon those key elements that, you know, you could go back and remind yourself again in those papers, and how they had their particular flavor on it. And again, of course, between the lines, reminding you of, I mean, almost everything that comes to be thought of as Judaism or the culture of the Jews, I mean, it's all old stuff that they're gathering, you know, as those peoples are kind of rolling around in the Near East and, you know, and producing this polyglot culture. Let's see, anything else there? Nope, I can't think of that. Just keep going. Although it does bring in healing agents, there's our healthcare again. The healthcare of Thoth.
The Egyptians long believed that the stars twinkling in the night sky represented the survival of the souls of the worthy dead. Other survivors, they thought, were absorbed into the sun. During a certain period, solar veneration became a species of ancestor worship. The sloping entrance passage of the Great Pyramid pointed directly towards the pole star, so that the soul of the king, when emerging from the tomb, could go straight to the stationary and establish constellations of the fixed stars, the supposed abode of the kings.
Yep. So, notice between the lines, you have some budding scientific clarity of that there's some similarity between the sun and the stars. Okay. You know, eventually you go, oh yeah, the sun is a star. See, they're getting to that in this very superstitious way. You know, and you can't help but wonder what's all behind that. Is there some insight underlying that? Is there some things that revelators said in the past, the first or second epical revelations, you know, or whatnot? But you know, just notice those fun little things where, despite the superstitions and the immaturity, there's a little thread of truth going on there. All right, let's keep going.
When the oblique rays of the sun were observed penetrating earthward through an aperture in the clouds, it was believed that they betokened the letting down of a celestial stairway whereon the king and other righteous souls might ascend. King Pepi has put down his radiance as a stairway under his feet whereon to ascend to the mother.
To his mother. Yeah. These, you know, texts, you know, these Egyptian texts that we have, tons and tons of, you know, like...
Yeah. And when you see this, if you're driving along, you've all seen it. You've read this, you can see how they could picture
right.
that.
Right.
But right. You didn't have any... They couldn't read, hardly. They didn't have anything really to write. I mean, so they really didn't have a lot of quote-unquote knowledge. So you can see how it was... But that, to me, as you were mentioning a second ago, it's just another step in them getting somewhere.
Yeah, right. And just, you know, think about the immediacy of what, you know, we're reading about the Melchizedek missionaries. They are delighted by those rays, right, coming down through the atmosphere. And, right, their eye is looking horizontal. They see it and they follow it up, right? Anything that can get people to turn their heads heavenward, as it were, right? To get you to lift your thoughts up. You know, in the previous one, you know, of making it so that it, you know, points towards the pole star, you know, again, orienting their perspective upward. All those things are potentials. No matter how material they are, in fact, right, there's a potential there for you to take that material, that literal material phenomenon, and analogize it internally, you know, mindily. It's like, well, the same way that I could lift my eyes in the external world up, I could lift my perspective upward in my mind. Right? I mean, most of the way we talk about the mind is analogized from the material world like that. Right? So it's a very important step in going from matter to mind, and then everyone is waiting for us to take the next step and go from mind to spirit, right? Not just have fancier and fancier religion of mind, but to actually get to religion of spirit. But one thing at a time, one step first. We have to get above matter first. All right.
When Melchizedek appeared in the flesh, the Egyptians had a religion far above that of the surrounding peoples. They believed that a disembodied soul, if properly armed with magic formulas, could evade the intervening evil spirits and make its way to the judgment hall of Osiris, where, if innocent of murder, robbery, falsehood, adultery, theft, and selfishness, it would be admitted to the realms of bliss. If this soul were weighed in the balances and found wanting, it would be consigned to hell, to the devourers. And this was, relatively, an advanced concept of a future life in comparison with the beliefs of many surrounding peoples.
Right, and you know, notice how you've got, you know, some duality, you know, in play there too. You know, so that's the whole classic thing of. You know, being weighed, and if you're found wanting, you know, that very composite totem-based creature, the devourous, you know, would have her way with you. You know, but like I said, and this was relatively an advanced concept. See, it's not advanced, in fact, But it is advanced in truth, what they're getting at there. This is, I've been stressing. All these things are little vignettes, you know, leading up to this, so that you can see that, don't judge it by its immediacy. Reflect on it a little bit. There's more there than meets the eye, right? There's a subtle, ever more insightful, exalting, you know, uplifting phenomenon, you know, threaded through all of that ignorance and kind of groping around in the dark that these humans are doing. And so there's always a way that mankind can be led up. And that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution will always achieve. Right? And you're seeing it here, just how what evolution can do in the most amazing, seemingly devoid of potential situations. Okay, and then the final little tidbit that they tease us with here.
The concept of judgment in the hereafter for the sins of one's life in the flesh on earth was carried over into Hebrew theology from Egypt. The word judgment appears only once in the entire book of Hebrew Psalms, and that particular psalm was written by an Egyptian.
And what they mean by that is judgment in this sense, you know, not so much like wise judgment or, you know, things like that, but judgment in this sense and based upon, like they're saying, what was literally in Egyptian, you know, just translated over into Hebrew. Okay? And I'm pretty sure we're talking about the first psalm here. Right, which Amanda Mope wrote. Yeah. As they'll tell you later. You know, and if you look in the first psalm, you'll look for the word judgment in there, you go, oh, yeah, that's that whole Egyptian thing. That's, yeah. Right. They were just summarizing for you. Right, that's where it came from. Yeah, so, the Jews... we'll talk an awful lot as we go forward about the Hebrews, and they benefited from some of the best of what was there in the Near East. Is what, you know, when all is said and done, is what they're getting at. It's why it was such an obvious option for Gabriel to pick there for the incarnation of Jesus.
Right. Well, I looked at a couple other places.
Yeah, right. There was other places. Egypt. Right. We can see, you know, some of the other places. But a lot came, you know, was there to be built upon as evolutional foundation. You know, and they already pointed out, you know, oh yeah, Jesus worked with that, you know, he built upon that. So anyway, that's, you know, That's the basics of what they're trying to do here, is saying that even though the Melchizedek missionaries had difficulties, seeds were sown that fed forward in helpful ways. And evolution filled in a lot of the blanks that the Melchizedek missionaries, you know, dropped the ball on, that which revelation failed to accomplish, right? You know, this whole fascinating backing into an evolutionary process achieved, so that there was enough there for the fourth epical revelation.
And that was their whole purpose.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
The fourth wasn't coming here, the third may not have happened.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, yeah, that's what, between the direct efforts coming down from Mach Aventa and evolution's delightful ability to fill in the blanks, you know, it was, what you needed was there. All right, so then we'll continue on with this the next time. Get a little bit more into some of the further details. Because remember they mentioned it was political and moral. So, you know, the evolution of moral concepts. They want to talk about that. That's some more here in the next section. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.